history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that might just blow you away if you take the time to listen, ask the right questions. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. As we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And the gentleman you're going to meet today, you're probably not going to believe that he's 91 years old. You might not believe the things he's been through and how long it took for him to experience the breakthrough that led to his book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. Jack Gutman is our guest today, fresh off a stand-up comedy tour in Laughlin, Nevada. Maybe we'll laugh a little bit today as well. For many years, your service in the war was no laughing matter. But I want to go way back before that, Jack, because your life story is pretty unique, pretty interesting, even down, as I read in your book, to the way your parents met. Tell me about your mom and dad.
Well, my father was in World War I. He spoke seven languages in the Orient there. He asked for discharge there and went to work in Shanghai, China, in a hotel there. He was like a concierge, you know, because he spoke so many languages, they took him right away. Well, my mother and her father and her sisters and brother, they were rich Russians. And when the Bolsheviks took over, they had to leave quickly because it was dangerous for them. They carried two suitcases, no clothes in the suitcases, jewelry and money. And they went off and they went to Shanghai, China, and they checked into this hotel. And my mother was smitten by my father and vice versa. And my grandfather did not like him because he was a commoner and it didn't want her to have anything to do with her, but things prevailed. And the next thing, they fell in love and they came to the United States. Of course, she became an American citizen. There were nine children and they traveled from San Francisco all the way to New York City. I was born in San Francisco, and the various children were born in various states going across. And that's the way the whole family started. It was really an interesting thing. My father, I don't know how he did it with nine children, because in 1929, I think it's when the Depression hit, I think I was about 5 years old. I was born 1925. And of course, as a kid, you don't know anything, but we did not have great meals. Now, my mother came from wealth, and when she married my father, there was no wealth there. I mean, he had to work for everything. And so she adjusted to that. And then with the children coming, my mother made what we call the bulgur wheat, called kasha. And my mother made it for breakfast with milk and sugar. Then she made, she would use that with vegetables and so forth. Meat was a rarity. We never saw meat. I think I used to kid and say, when they used to hang meat in the butcher shops in the old days, when I saw it, I thought a terrible accident had happened. You know? Seriously, it was that. We didn't have anything like that.
Well, you talk about rare, and, you know, I often speak with veterans on this show, and I talk about, well, if you didn't survive this and this and this, your children and your grandchildren wouldn't be here. I'm thinking about your case. If a fleeing Russian aristocrat doesn't meet an American in Shanghai, China, and over the objections of her father, marry him, then you're not here right now.
Absolutely. You know, an interesting thing when you bring that up, my grandchildren, when they were smaller, and they were with their cousins and so forth, we were at a party. And I walked into the television room, and they were watching a band of brothers. And I said, what are you watching? And they said, the band of brothers. It's about the World War II. And they said, Grandpa, you were there, weren't you? And I said, no, I was on the beach of Normandy. But those were the parachuters that came in and so forth. And then all of a sudden, one of them, I mean, as small as they are, one of them said, Grandpa, I thought of something. If you were there and you got killed, we wouldn't be here. And they all came around me and hugged me, brought tears to my eyes. You know, it was really touching. And I said, they got it. They got it, you know, and this is the way it was. And the kids really appreciate it now. I mean, especially when I speak at different places, or they threw a 90th birthday for me, and they entertained me singing and everything. I have a great family. We come from a hugging, kissing family, you know. Uh-huh. It's the way the Europeans are.
Sure.
So back to what you said, it is ironic that all happened. Is true. And that's the way fate is, you know, when you think about it.
So for you as a boy, you mentioned the food situation. What about you? Did you have some things you were doing already that led to what you did later? Or did you have some hopes, some dreams, some ambitions where you said, boy, when I grow up, here are the things that Jack's going to do?
Well, I went through the phase of a fireman, a policeman, and so forth like that. My father was a wallpaper installer. He worked hard taking care of the family, doing that. And so up until when I was a kid, I worked in a factory. And what I thought about, I had an inclination always toward medicine and so forth like that. So ironically, when I went into the service, I was going to be an aerial radio man, but then they were killing the Japanese were killing the medics a lot. Big Red Cross on a helmet and a patch on the arm. So we were perfect targets. So then I wound up in there. But the interesting thing, I really couldn't stand the sight of blood. You know, if I saw blood, I got really queasy about the thing. But here I was thinking I had wanted to become a medical. But later on, I became used to it, and that was my goal. I wanted to become a doctor.
And before you got in the service, this is something I like to ask everybody because you all seem to remember it. December 7th, 41, how'd you find out about what happened?
I used to belong to a gang called the Panthers.
And you mean a real gang?
The real
New
gang.
York street gang.
New York street gang, yeah. We used to have fights. We used to do crazy things. We used to jump from one roof to the other over a six-foot deal. We lost one of our good buddies. He hit the edge and lost his balance. And we used to hitchhike on the back of buses. We did crazy things.
Did your parents know about any of this?
No. If they saw that, they would have died. I mean, because my mother had nine kids. She had to, you know, get food ready, clothing, and so there was no cell phones, nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
No. Not even a phone in our house, you know. We would all go out, but my father had a rule. When he leaned out the window when he came home from work, and he whistled, and he had a special whistle that went, whoosh, whoosh. We heard it. We had to come because it was dinner time, and we sat there, and we all ate together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it was.
So you're in the Panthers.
I was with the group once. We were on a street corner, and then somebody was saying, oh, this happened. So we heard about it from some nearest store. There was a radio or something was on. It wasn't TV then, but radio. And we heard about that, and I was stunned because we used to get those little jewelry boxes. You know, you buy them for 10, 15 cents or something that were made in, you know, Japan and so forth. And we would think, well, that's all they are. They're just a little country. And we heard that they attacked us. And I said, I can't believe it. It really got me. Was very patriotic. Most of our gang was all patriotic. As wild as we were patriotic. All of the guys wanted to join, but they had to wait till they hit certain ages.
Yeah, you were a couple weeks shy of your 16th birthday. So yeah,
that's right.
Little
and
too
I had
young
to wait
to
my 17th, yeah.
Out of curiosity, what's the stupidest thing you ever did in that gang that maybe you look back on now and say, boy, I'm lucky I survived that.
Yeah, well, actually, the stupidest thing, I think, was leaping from one roof to the other. The buildings there in New York City was six stories high. There was a six-foot space in between each building. So we would go up on a roof, and we would jump from one to the other. Mm. The other stupid thing we did, we would have BB gun fights from one roof to the other. And guess what's sticking up? Our heads.
Yeah.
And stupidly, I mean, what are you going to get? Probably shot in the eye. I was just fortunate it didn't happen. When you say stupid, that is stupid.
Yeah. And when you say you all wanted to go in, how palpable was that for you? How badly did you want to go into the service right after Pearl Harbor?
I wanted to go right away. I mean, to me, we were like gung-ho. I want to go there and kill those Japanese people. One thing I've learned about the Japanese people, they were tough fighters, which I found out in Okinawa. But that was my goal at that time as a kid, to go into service, to fight for my country.
And you would do that a year later.
Yes.
Had you finished high school yet?
No. As a matter of fact, I had about a year and a half left, and I eventually wound up after I came out, I went back and got my GED and then went on to other higher education afterwards.
So in order to join at 17, you had to get your parents to sign for you.
Absolutely. I begged my father. I was just getting close to almost 17 and a half then, and he signed for me, and I went in. They paid us $50 a month. But out of that $50, I sent $25 home to my family. I said, I'll send you half my money back, too. Well, they could use it because that went a long way. You know,
sure.
$50 was a lot of money at that time.
So what was it about the Navy that made you want to join that branch of service as opposed to another?
I checked up on the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. Marines was enticing, but then I figured, with the Marines, I'm always going to be hitting the beaches or whatever it is, and you're in there fighting. And I said, the Navy, this was my thinking, honestly. You're going to be on a ship or a base. You've got a bed to sleep in, or they had even beds or hammocks or whatever it was on the ships. Mm-hmm. And we would be able to have a clean life, good food all the time. We're out, we're traveling around, seeing different things. And I thought that was going to be great. I found out a lot of guys got exactly that. They stayed on the ship, and they got exactly what it was. But what happened to me is, after I finished medical school, then they trained us on how to take care of wounded on the beaches and everything. Well, we went through a lot. I actually got to the point where so many things happened. That's why I wanted to become a doctor. I mean, when I finished, I thought I could take a guy's appendix out in an emergency. That's how good, because I assisted in so many of them.
And how'd you get over being squeamish around blood? I mean, if you're afraid of seeing blood, I don't know why you want to be a corpsman.
No. Well, actually, I took tests when I went in.
Yeah.
And they said, you qualify for aerial radio man. And I thought, that sounds exciting. So I said, well, you'd be up there, and I'd be a tail gunner and a radio man. And now I knew God had to be watching over me, because, of course, I went through a lot of crap, too. But I learned later that a lot of those radio men and airmen, they lost so many lives, so many planes, and I probably could have bit the dust then with them. But
yeah.
What happened, like I said before, the Japanese were killing off a lot of the medics. So they took me from the aerial radio man. They said, you're going to go to Bainbridge Medical School. You're going to become a medic. And I'm going, medic? You know, and I thought, well, I wanted it, but I was, the blood thing came up back to me. But they gave us an accelerated course. It was a year course in 6 months, and we went 6 days a week. It started about 9 a.m. after breakfast. We finished up 8 o'clock that evening, just breaks for lunch or dinner.
Exhausting.
And that was 6 days a week, no leave. On Sunday, when we had that day off, we had our studies to do and then do whatever time you had left. That accelerated course, we went through hell learning things. You get over the squeamishness when they take you down to the morgue and then they show you, you want like to see the brain, they take and they cut the top off and you see the brain. And then when you go working on some of the people in the hospital where they're teaching you how to go through, you see some things you didn't want to see, but your body becomes accustomed to it. And then, of course, the war, that was another story. It was horrible.
Yeah, as you're going through all this training, and as exhausting and consuming as it sounds like it was, there are also things going on in the war. And you're hearing what's happening in the Pacific, what's happening in North Africa and Italy. Were you itching to get over there, or are you content to be where you are?
No, well, actually what they did is they trained us, and then the next thing, you know, after we finished our medical training, we were put aboard a ship. It was the Aquitania. It was a huge British ship that was going over to England.
Mm-hmm.
And we were with this huge medical group. We got to England, and then they took us to Scotland, Ireland, where we loaded up some equipment and so forth. And then we came back over to England. And for 4 to 5 months, we worked on a huge hospital there called Victoria Hospital. I tell you, you've never seen a hospital as big as this. It looked like it was a mile long. The British owned it, but they had let it just go to pot. And we had to go in to prepare that. We didn't know what we were preparing for, but it turned out it was going to be the Normandy invasion.
They knew there'd be so many casualties that they needed somewhere to bring them back to.
Yeah, they had a lot of hospitals, but this was one of the huge ones there. It was on beautiful grounds. It's no longer there anymore. They finally tore it down, but it was filthy and needed cleaning, so we had to make a spotless. So I think a little over 2,000 personnel went into it for the 4 months. We kind of cleaned it up, got ready. And then when the Normandy invasion was getting ready to start, and of course we didn't know what. It was the biggest hush-hush thing of all.
Did you hear rumblings? Did you hear anything? Did you hear some rumors that you guys were going to go across?
No, there's a rumor. The rumors were crazy. They were just talking about, we're going to be invading, but we had no idea where. It was a big hush-hush. Then I got picked up with a group from our group. We were picked up to do some special training. They said, we're going to teach you landing on the beach, you know. And so there was a place in England that we took about that. There was about 50 of us corpsmen out of the whole crew. We were swore that we would have complete silence, no talking about this, not even to our best buddies. None of them even knew what was going to go on. But they said, if any of this slips out here, you'll go in jail or you'll be court-martialed or a shot. As far as that goes. So we went and had practice invasions and so forth. Climbing down nets was weird, especially when the water is up and down, and that's what happened in Normandy. But anyway, it was intense training. But our job was just to, they were telling us, everything was if a battle starts, but we have to go in there, your job is we practice what we were going to do. You hit the beaches, patch them up, and evacuate them. And we did that constantly. So we were trained. We were not going to be where we were going to hit a beach and keep going in like the service guys. The invasion itself was just so devastating that I was in survival mode. There are a lot of instances where men died because of friendly fire. Well, all my job was to take care of the people. And it became very, very personal to me. Because when you're a medic, you're looking at a man that's dying or very badly wounded, and he's looking at you, and he's depending upon you. He's screaming out, and it becomes very, very personal.
And in Jack's case, quite haunting for decades. Time for a break. But if you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a link to Jack Gutman's book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. That journey continues when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today in Orange County, California with 91-year-old Jack Gutman, a man who experienced the gruesome realities of the D-Day invasion as a teenage Navy corpsman. Let's go back now to that first week of June in 1944.
We got the call, our group, and as I said, we were under deep secrecy. They made up a lot of fake things, like for Calais. They made it look like Calais was going to be the landing place.
All the way down to, like, inflatable tanks and stuff
like
that. They
had inflatable tanks and sound effects and trucks. I mean, that was amazing. Now, I found this all out later, the messages they were sending out. And it was brilliant. God bless Eisenhower and his staff, I mean, and what they did. Well, it turned out, they got us and they said, okay, you're not to go back to the base. We're loading up and stuff. And they put us on this APA. They had a lot of ships. We were going somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I've had apprehensions that it was going to be something big. What the Germans saw on the 6th, when they like come up and all that, there were 5,000 ships, 4,500 landing craft. There was 11,000 planes of various sorts, and there was 150,000 men were going to hit 5 beaches. Ours was going to be Utah and Omaha. I was planned for Utah, as I thought, you know, but there was a lot of current, and we drifted. So I know we went off close to Omaha, between those two or near there, because the casualties were horrendous there. So what happened, the water was very choppy. We started coming down the nets, and we lost a couple guys that went off the ropes in between the LCVPs, that's the landing crafts.
Yeah.
In between.
So you're just trying to get from the APA down to the LCVP, yeah, and guys are falling and drowning.
When you're climbing, as soon as you get down to where the boat is going up and down.
Sure.
I mean, huge waves. They get you on the up thing, and you got to jump in, and the guys catch you and bring you in the boat. Some guys let go too soon, and when it was on there, and they went in between the boat and the ship with the heavy packs on their back, they went straight down. They couldn't get the packs off enough time. And so we lost some men doing that. I mean, one was on the net that I was coming down, and I just couldn't believe that. I mean, that was my first shock.
Ugh.
I mean, I had thought of things that I was going to see Paul. But as we came in and we get into the LCVPs and the water is very rough, and all of a sudden you see the cannons going off, I mean, from the ships, the shells.
Yeah.
When you're close enough where you can see as you know, you're going bivouacking around until your wave come in. First, second, third, fourth wave, those guys are the forces that go in. They caught it badly. My job is just to take care of the wounded. So we're like in a 14th wave or something like that, or I don't know, because we're in to take care of the wounded. We're not in for the shooting or action. Carried a 45, no rifles. You carry medical pack 45. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the Pacific. When I see the shells hitting the beach, I said to myself, there isn't going to be a thing alive on that beach. It just won't be. When it came our time, when we went in, you hear planes going over and so forth. You figure, oh, well, this is it. I mean, it's going to be a cakewalk. They're going to drop all those bombs. Unfortunately, Paul, these bunkers, big German bunkers were up there where they could shoot down on their beaches. They had a machine gun, could shoot off 150 bullets a minute.
Yeah.
When they went to drop the bomb, it was cloud cover, and they could not see the beach of the bunkers. So they were told, which I found out, they were told, when you think you're near the beach, count three and drop the bombs, because they didn't want to hit the guys down there.
Yeah, not the, yeah, the allies coming in.
Right, allies. So what happened, all the bombs dropped on the other side about 2 miles in. It was almost by the time they dropped, the bombs hit. Nothing hit the bunkers. There was some shelling that the ships got that took care of some things there.
Yeah, you can still find those craters if you go there,
right,
today.
Right, yeah. And then what happens, you got all of those guys that were coming in on the first, second, third, wherever, they just, some never got a shot off. Now, one of the problems was they had these big girders in the water and other obstacles. Let me clarify something. When you go in for an invasion, your LCVP or your landing craft, you go right up to the beach, and then the thing drops down, and you run off onto the beach. That's the normal pattern. That's what you practice for. But the Germans had all of these barriers there, plus landmines and everything else. They had to stop, so we had to stop way out there and wade in water up to our chests. When the machine guns started going off on this thing here, the guys panicked. A lot of guys were seasick. They were throwing up over each other. It was a mess. But they leaped off the side of the boat instead of waiting for the ramp to go down. And the water was so deep there, with the heavy pack, if they couldn't get the pack off, they drowned. Mm. Never got a shot off. It was like a nightmare. Rommel had set up 35,000 mines on the beaches with the barbed wire. They were supposed to get these tanks that were supposed to come in and the demolition crews that makes the path so the guys can go right through. The water was so rough and they could not come all the way up to the beach, you see. They,
yeah,
dropped the thing so the tank could roll off. So they had these devices where the tank would be on that were made special for them, with a little motor in the back, and the tank would go up close to it. But when the water was so rough, it flipped the tank. The guys drowned right into the tank if they couldn't get out. We were talking about nightmares. That was one of the big nightmares that happened. Did not plan on it. It was a great idea, but that's what it was. So no big tanks hit so they could clear the beaches. So when I'm talking to anyone, I tell people, I said, if you watch Saving Private Ryan, the movie, they portrayed it the best that I've ever seen, but it was only like half what it was, because the only thing it did show, it was vivid and very accurate, but what they didn't show was all the body parts. And when I think of it, that's what got me. And then you got these guys on the beach wounded when you finally land on the beach, and guys are screaming, "Mama, mama." And then they look at you and then they say, "Doc, am I going to live?" And you have to lie to them, because you know who's got, if they're going to die or not, and all, and becomes like a nightmare, and you're in survival mode. And then you're always thinking in your mind, did I do the right thing? When I gave him that morphine shot to ease his pain and all, did I do enough? When I patched this up here, did it work okay? All these things spin in your mind, and all you're doing is going from one to the other. And then somebody says, well, you know, you're out in the open. What were some of the barriers? And that was like some of my nightmares that I went through in post-traumatic stress afterward. What you had to do sometime, if you had a guy and you had to drag him along to try to take care of him, you had another body that was dead, an American soldier, a kid. Excuse me. God keeps remembering me back. That you're using as a protection. It was like hell. I mean, hell.
So to try to save one injured soldier, you had to use a killed, a dead, a deceased American soldier as a shield.
Yeah, because there's not enough barriers there. Whatever girders or what you could hide behind or drag over there or dig in the sand or whatever you could, it was just horrible. And that was the way it was. I was on the beach the whole time. I think we were on about 6 or 7 hours, you know. But the bodies in the water floating around, I mean, guys laying around, it was just a horrible, horrible thing. And then what happened, I kept thinking, especially looking at the body parts, is that I thought quickly, could be like my brother or a friend. There's a father that'll never go home. There was a son that'd never go home. You see all this, and that all stays with you. Not at that time, it builds up in your head. And people constantly always said to me, because after that invasion was over, and I evacuated him, we got him back to the ships, and when we had enough, we took him back to the hospital that we had. So we were on the beach that time. Thank God we did it, and thank God for the men, the guys that died. And I remember people who used to say to me, have you ever gone over there to Normandy or any of these places? And I said, no, I didn't want to even face it, because, see, the things that was happening to me after that invasion was, and Paula, my daughter, asked me once when I was writing my book, what was your post-traumatic stress like? And I said, well, it's different with each person. It was just horrible. She said, well, don't you think your readers would like to know that? And I said, okay. So I finally sat down very reluctant about it, because it was very traumatic for me. And when you're writing it, I mean, I'm crying because I'm visualizing all these things that happened. But what you see in my post-traumatic stress, I see the invasion, it'll happen some flashes. A lot of times when you're relaxing or going to sleep, especially sleeping, where you see the invasion over and over again, it keeps happening, but it's magnified. And you see the guy screaming, mama, mama, and the wounded, and you see the body parts, everything's magnified. The shelling, everything is big. It's like a nightmare. And I remember the same thing happened, like Normandy was one thing. Okinawa was another thing that was very devastating.
There's a fair amount of time between, and we're talking June of 44 to April of 45.
That's right.
And in between, you're in England at the hospital? At what point did you move to the Pacific?
What happened, I went after we evacuated the guys there.
Yeah.
And it turned out, by the way, in Normandy, we lost 9,000 men. Just a horrible thing. Well, I took care of them. I was at the hospital there for 2 months after the invasion, taking care of all the wounded there. Ironically, there was a guy that I patched up on the beach. He got shot here.
Right,
and there was a lot of blood, you know, and everything. And so I remember patching him up and giving him a shot. And he said, Doc, I'll tell you one thing. At least I'm going to go home, you know. And I said, yeah, you're going to make it home, you know. And he wound up in hospital. Now, he was an officer. When I got back there, they sent me after the other thing. And I still couldn't tell the guys at my thing that where I had been. It was still all secret.
So the people who stayed behind at the hospital.
The guys there, even some of my buddies that I had, I just couldn't tell them. I said, let me know when. They said, we'll tell you. And I could not say anything because I figured court-martial. Even though it was over now. But we took care of him and we got the wounded. Now this officer, I wound up in officer's ward there, taking care of the wounded. He was there. And that's another thing that bothered me. Where he got shot, it sealed off so no blood was going down the leg and all. Mm. It sealed some artery or whatever it was there. And they had to amputate his leg just above the knee. So when I saw him there, I'll never forget his name. His name was Pat Prendeville. So we got to talking, and he was going to get ready and go home, though. The other thing that happened, there was another guy I took care of in that officer's ward. He was visualizing as he was in a sort of semi-coma. He was talking about the battle on Normandy. Well, he got shot. And he was losing spinal fluid. And when you lose spinal fluid, the doctor had always told me he doesn't have much longer to live. I got to talking to him. He told me he had a wife and a kid and that he's looking forward to going home. And I got to know him and it became so personal. And then he started going through this delirium. And then he would start talking. He would be talking very fast. Then he would start going like, all this gibberish. It was like nothing. And then finally he died. Now, if a guy dies on your watch when you're taking care of him, I happened to be on duty when he died. This is the crazy thing, and I had to do it 4 times. You have to pack every cavity in his body with cotton. But it was not something I always talk about, but it was something that was just very traumatic for me. So you see, Paul, all these things just built up. So after I was there for a couple of months doing all of this and going through all of that thing and remembering and going through the flashbacks, because I started getting them when I started sleeping, but I thought this is something they didn't know anything about post-traumatic stress. All right. They knew is they called it shell shock. I figured I had to live with it. And I figured when I get home, maybe it'll all be over. Now, I also thought, now that I got leave to go home for 30 days to see my family in New York, when I got the leave, I was wonderful, had a good time, and I thought, this is going to be better because I'm in a different atmosphere. Flashbacks kept going. It was scary. I said, if I go to the doctors, they're going to... I thought they put me in a mental institution, very honestly, for what I was going through. Then it turned out, after my 30-day leave there, I said, I'm going to get stateside duty, hospital. You know, I've been overseas. I've done it. And apparently that's when the Japanese were killing all of the guys over in the other islands. They sent me to Oceanside, California, and I started training. I was with what they call the beach battalion. We were medics for the Marines. We were going to hit beaches. Mm-hmm. So we went through practice invasions and stuff like that. What happened is that we went through a lot of the training with the Marines. Marines are tough, tough guys. Oh, God, yeah. I thought I was hard and all that stuff, what I went through and all. But when my first day out with the Marines, because I had to train with them and carry the packs and everything else that they do, they were in a hot sun. They're going through the calisthenics and everything else. Next thing I know, I wound up in the hospital. It's like heat stroke. But it passed out because of the sun. But they toughened me up. I got it. So we wound up at the training with the Marines and all, and then my beach battalion group, we were put aboard a ship, and we were sent to Pearl Harbor. I was on a ship called the Cullman. In Pearl Harbor, we practiced invasions again, only it's a different tactic of a way because of the Pacific, climbing down nets. And we went through all of this business with these guys. See, one of the things is this. I'm one of the few veterans that are still alive that have been in both theaters of war. That not too many do it. And I think the only reason they sent me there is because of my medical experience there. And they needed medics over there. And one of the practice invasions at one of the islands, it was like a deserted island there. Right? Maybe it's luscious now with
in Hawaii? People.
Hawaii, yeah. Uh-huh. But I can't remember. Whatever the island, it was like a desolate island. We practiced an invasion. And then after we secured, you go in and there's shells and everything else. But when we settled down for that night, you dig in, make a little foxhole for yourself and you sleep because that's what you're going to do over there.
Sure.
So what happens, two guys dug a foxhole, two near the road. and a tank went over them. And being a medic, they called for the medic. So myself and another guy, we were called to go over there. Oh. It was like mincemeat to see these two young men there. I mean, it was like mincemeat. And I'm now 18, you see. And I'm looking at this and I'm figuring, this was practice. And these guys are dead now because of that, of an accident. You talk about crazy accidents, there's one. That made a big impact on my brain. I have never forgot that vision, you know. There's nothing we can do there. I just said, no, it's just they have to scoop them up or whatever they have to do to it. There's nothing we do. But to see it was really a tough thing. I got transfers from the Cullman to another APA, this auxiliary personnel assault, called the Bowie. Now, we joined a force going the Pacific, and it was a large force. And I said, we're going for some big invasion somewhere. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what it was. Turned out to be Okinawa.
And we'll hear what Jack witnessed there when we come back. Don't forget to find photos, video, and a link to his book at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf, and the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I wish we had more time today with 91-year-old Jack Gutman of Anaheim, California. Maybe you'll catch him at one of his ongoing stand-up comedy shows. But if you pick up his book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War, I do have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll know it was no laughing matter when this veteran of the D-Day invasion arrived 11 months later at Okinawa to start tending to casualties of that massive Pacific battle.
In Okinawa, it wasn't like Normandy. On the beach, there wasn't that much problem. In the inner deals, like where the caves and all of what they got, see, the soldiers and everything went in. I think a good picture that people should see today or get it is Hacksaw Ridge. I was there when the Hacksaw Ridge was going on at that time.
Right.
But I was on the beach taking care of the wounded. And, Paul, we lost 14,000 men died. 62,000 wounded. It was horrendous. It was like a mess. I never saw anything like it in my life. And then the worst things of all that, with all of Okinawa, you see all of this again on top of what happened already. This is the 18-year-old guy seeing this, a kid. And then all of a sudden, when I went back to my ship and we're taking care of the wounded there, I'm taking a break. I'm walking along the deck, and all of a sudden, just when I happened to be near this big gun that was on the ship, all of a sudden I hear an alarm go off, and then all of a sudden I hear, boom! I felt a ring in my ear. I lost half my hearing on that thing. This is another incident that got me. Never forgot it. There's a picture of it, I think, in my book. I saw the kamikaze planes coming in. They were Japanese kamikaze planes. These are young men, 17, 18, 19 years old, that had one third thing. They got in a plane with a bomb on it, and they go one way, and they're going to go and crash into a ship. And I had never seen this before. My job is to heal people. Paul, I actually saw this. It was the battleship New Mexico was like a football field away from me, from my ship, the Bowie. And I'm running to my station, and I look over, and I see this Japanese kamikaze plane come real low. I could actually see his, you know, that stern look that they have. And then all of a sudden, he veered the plane and went right into the bridge of the battleship New Mexico. I stood there stunned, and I said, I just saw that man alive, and now he's dead, and look what he did to those people. I had never seen that before. My job is to heal people, and here someone takes his life. Never saw that. Today, you got people blowing themselves up and all that. But at that time, no, that was traumatic. It took me a long time to get over that thing here. So it was just, the kamikaze planes were just constant. Now, I understand there was about 4,000 of them, and 10% got through. The lot got shot down. But that 10%, which would be about 400, hit a lot of ships, a lot of lives lost, and it was just a horrible mess, you know. And then after the Okinawa thing, and we went back, and I figured, okay, there's two invasions, I'm back, maybe now. We got a 5-day leave, and then we loaded up again, and we're on our way with a huge armada. We're on our way to invade Japan. Our base was going to be Sasebo, Japan, which was the naval base there. I'll tell you something, Paul. There's a picture I think I have somewhere in there where it shows a ship going into this. It looked like an inlet, and on each side there are big hills with caves, and we had to go into this thing. We would have been like ducks in the water. We were on the way, and they dropped the bomb, and all of a sudden they said they dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, then Nagasaki. And said, oh, boy, then they're going. Then they said, continue on going. Then they dropped the Nagasaki, and they said the war is over. So we said, oh, good, we're going to go back to Pearl Harbor. They said, go in to your landing place that you were going to go. So we went in. Thank God. When I saw this and I saw those cliffs, and I figured we were going to.
When you got to Sasebo and you saw where you came in and pictured it, if the war were still going on and where the Japanese positions would have been.
We would have lost thousands and thousands. The Japanese, I saw what they did in Okinawa. They will fight. They hadn't lost a war in 1,000 years. And therefore, those people were fighters. And they were also told by the homeland, don't come back if you lose the war. So a lot of them committed harakiri or killed themselves rather than go back or surrender. And so these people in Japan were going to be fighting to the last man or woman or child. And when I speak at different groups, I always tell them, I want you to think of something. Had the Japanese not surrendered, there was a man named Mitsubishi, and Mr. Sani was a kid there, a young person, who finally wound up developing televisions and all these electrical things the Japanese had. Plus, there was a whole bunch of Americans that lived that didn't have to die in that battle that invented a lot of things that we are now enjoying.
Good
Think
point.
How the world would have been changed, how it would have been changed. So I said, very good. When we hit that beach, they were waving to us. So we took over. We stayed there for, I think it was a month and a half. Mm-hmm. And then our ship later took us back to Pearl Harbor. We loaded up other people that were sick people or whatever it may be, back to San Pedro. When I got to San Pedro, I got a 5-day lead, and I still was having all these flashbacks. And then finally I get back to the ship, and we're leaving in the morning to go back to the Pacific for 3 more months. They had an all-nav bulletin there, and it said, if you got 31 points because you were overseas, you got so many points, you can be discharged. I had joined for the duration of the war, almost went for 4 years, but I took the duration of war, and I wound up 2.5 years, you see. I had 33 points, and I went over to the yeoman, and I said, hey, I got 33 points, and he told me, you're full of crap or something like that. And I said, no, check my record. So when he said, he called and he looked and he called the captain and says, Gutman's got 33 points. He says, get him off the ship now. So my shipmates helped me pack, and they give me the captain's dinghy to go into San Pedro from the ship, you know. So they give me their, they didn't know what to do with me. I gave them the papers, and they said, we don't know, we got to get your other papers ready for the discharge and your trip home and so forth. So they gave me a 24-hour pass and gave me some money. So I went to Los Angeles, and I had a nice time. When I come back, they had my ticket and everything, and then they said to me, have you ever been wounded or anything? And I said, no, because I said, if I tell them about the flashbacks, they're going to keep me, and I wanted to be home. It was December, and it was near my birthday. I said, no, I'm fine, no problem. And so they gave me it. Otherwise, they would have held me over. I was got home for my birthday and was home for Christmas. I had missed two Christmases already, you see. I was with my family. Everything was great. I was discharged. I thought everything would be great. But then I had started having those flashbacks, and it scared the heck out of me. It was just all of those sights kept coming back to me and all of them. Finally, I didn't want to say anything about it. I wasn't in the show business. I was a comedian. I went under the name of Jackie Walker. See what happened? My uncle happened to be in show business.
Mm-hmm.
He was a dancer and singer with his wife, Sarah. He traveled all around the country. So he came home to New York. He was having dinner with us and all. And my father said, Jackie does a lot of jokes and impersonations of different actors and so forth like that. And so I did a little joke for him or something like that. I think what I did is I told him the joke about a lady sitting on a train and a guy comes by and he says, Lady, I don't want to think you're starting off with you, but that ring on your finger, biggest diamond I ever saw. And she said, no, you like this diamond. This is the Klotman diamond. Said, the what? Said, the Klotman diamond. It's like the Hope diamond. It comes with a curse. Said, what kind of curse comes with the Klotman diamond? She says, Mr. Klotman. So my uncle said, you know, I could work you in our show if you can work out a half an hour routine or something. He said, well, try it and then give me a call. So I did, and about a month later or something, I called him and I did a little routine for him on the phone. And he sent me some money and he said, come down to Florida. And next thing you know, I was in show business and everything was going well. And then the craziest thing had happened. I left Florida and I went to Charleston. I wasn't too interested in God. A guy from the orchestra. Orchestra men are wild. They got groupies that always want to go with them and everything else. And they live a wild life. And he sat next to me. I was having coffee in between shows. I did some risque stuff when I was in show business. And then he said to me, Jackie, do you know Jesus? And I said, yeah, I know of him. And he said, you ever accept him? I said, no. He said, would you like to accept him? I said, no. And he said, why not? And I told him the truth. I said, because I got these pet sins I'm enjoying, and I don't want to give them up. And he said, are you kidding? And I said, no, I mean it. I don't want to give them up. He said, why don't you accept Jesus and tell him you'll accept him as your Savior, but tell him you got these pet sins that you don't want to give them up. If he doesn't want you to have them, let him take it away. Now, that was a challenge to me. And I said, okay, and I said it that way. Once I said it, and then all of a sudden gave me another little Bible thing. And the next thing you know, I started to have to change some of my material. Just things changed. I finally made a decision. My life, I've never looked back from there. I've never been happier. And it's made a big difference in my life now. Now my years now is I want to touch lives. That's all. That's why I did it with my book. And when I speak at something like that, the money aspect is not what I'm interested in. The thing is I want people to know that they can go through such hell and all. The post-traumatic stress was my thing that I carried on, and that was hard for me, and I carried it 66 years.
What finally changed? What
I destroyed my marriage. I almost lost my wife. We almost got divorced because of I started medicating myself with drinking. Heavy. If you invited me to your house, I would never come with just one bottle of wine. I'd bring a magnum of champagne and a gallon of wine. A gallon. You know why? I didn't care whether you drink it. I didn't want to run out. That's how I was medicating myself. Mm. And my downfall, I'm not ashamed now. I want people to learn that you could go low. I was sitting with my family on Thanksgiving, and I had been drinking a lot of wine and champagne. And when he came to set the table, I passed out my face into the plate in front of my whole family. It was a traumatic time for me. But my daughter, Paula, she handles grief and people with alcoholism and all. And she talked me into going to a grief thing and then also to go to AA. So I went through those things, and her deal helped me a great deal in her grief. It was like a 12-week course. And I found out what the root of my problem was, you see. That got me out of the alcohol thing. And then finally I decided that I was at Veterans Hospital, and he asked me, you ever been wounded? And I told him, I said, I'll tell you the truth now. If you want to put me to some mental institution, I'm just going to deny everything. But I've been having these flashbacks, and I told him. And he said, you got post-traumatic stress. I never heard of it, you see. Then he said, I'll line you up with a deal. So he handed me up with a therapist, and there's a guy named Dylan Bender is the name. First I saw a psychiatrist, and then I saw Dylan for 3.5 years. My first session with him, he took me back, and it was so traumatic for me. After I finished my first session with him, he said, well, these are big melting cubes, Jack. You'll have to melt them down, and then you'll be able to talk about it or write about it or do anything. Because, see, I got to the point where I would never even tell anyone I was even in the Navy. If a guy started talking about war, I'd change the subject, or I'd say, they said, weren't you in the service? I said, yeah, I was in the Navy, and then I'd make a joke or do something else. Mm-hmm. And I kept striving to not go into a depression, but to better myself. So I excelled in a lot of work and things in show business. I did well in sales. I did well, but I was having that problem. But once I went for the therapy, I went through 3.5 years. Finally, I got to writing things down about when I was talking to my therapist, Dylan. Boy, he was a godsend to me, that man. I still see him occasionally. Finally, I decided to write the book. They put in for the pension. They said they were missing some of my papers. And then one guy says, John, I don't know if you really qualify. Well, after about 6 months of going back and forth with this, I blew up and I wrote and I said, who in the hell are you to tell me I don't qualify? I wrote this all out. Do you know what it is to see guys dying in your arms and screaming, mama, mama, and see body parts? Do you know what it's like and all that thing? Well, don't ever... And so I wrote this all down, and I went and saw Loretta Sanchez, the congresswoman. I showed her my letter, and she said, we're going to help you. And then she wrote to them, and they found my other papers. I had already gone through financial problems. It's all in my book, and I still wanted to touch lives. As a matter of fact, I had a situation with a friend of mine named Steve Gonzalez. He called me one time when I'm in a rough spot, and he said, Jack, could you come down to Pasadena where I'm at? We can talk and pray about things. And I said, Steve, I got 16 cents to my name and a quarter of a tank. He said, you come down, I'll fill your tank. That's when gas was running about 350 or something a gallon. It was high. He filled my tank. We had breakfast. We talked. We prayed. And then he gave me $20. Well, honest to God, and I've put it in my book. I was heading home. I couldn't stand it. I pulled over, and I cried. And I said, God, I don't want to be a beggar anymore. I want to be a giver. A couple of weeks later, we were on food stamps. I mean, that's how low things got financially, the things got. And I was getting food from the food bank. That couldn't be lower. The phone rings, and this guy says to me, Mr. Gubbin, I'm from the Veterans, and just wanted to tell you that you've been approved. And he gave me the percentage, which was high. And he says, and you're going to get X amount of dollars every single month from now on. Well, it was like a godsend. Paul, I tell you, it was like, I can't believe he said, no, I saw your record. You deserve it. Then he said to me, what is your bank account number? And now I figured I was being scammed, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. So I said, my bank account number. And he said, oh, I know how you feel. You gave your bank account number when you filled out all your papers when you first went to the vets. And he said, your number is this. And I was following mine. And he gave me the exact number. I said, yeah, that's it. He says, this Friday, X amount of dollars, which was high from way back when they started, will be deposited in your account this Friday. It was like God had just rained it down on me. Our financial problems was over, and from that point on, here I finally got cured of my, after 3.5 years of therapy, and I finally wrote the book, and my whole life has changed. It's been there. So now I touch lives financially if I can do it, and or spiritually I'll do it. And the other thing, and I'm sincere about this, I mean it, I realize what some people did for me. There were people that touched my life. That food bank, I sent them a check every single month. It's my way of reciprocating.
And with regard to the book, did you write the book for personal catharsis and closure, or?
Actually, both. It helped me. I wanted to express what I was going through, the good and bad, and then let people know that they don't have to go through a war. They don't have to go through all the stuff I went through. People go through it with marriage problems and everything else. When I speak at some groups and their couples, I tell them this. We spend so much time thinking the grass is greener on the other side. But if you would water the grass you got, you'd be surprised how much greener it would get. So give love and you get love back. Pretend your spouse is like a cup. fill it full of love, and all that overflows is yours.
I guess you've been practicing that for a few years.
Oh, yeah. My wife and I, we just finished celebrating June 22nd, 70 years together, and it was up and down, and only God took care of that.
And if there's anything else that's important to you, feel free to share. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story so candidly and for writing it down in this book, One Veteran's Journey to Heal the Wounds of War. It's one veteran's journey. It's your story.
Yeah.
But you know as well as I do, it's a parallel journey for so many veterans.
Absolutely.
And I get the sense that's another reason you wrote this book, to help them.
When I've been on the radio, I've asked people, they said to me, was it worth it? And I said, I plead to you veterans that are going through post-traumatic stress or any problem due to war or whatever it may be, get help.
Such an important message, and it carries so much weight when it comes from someone who has walked through it for most of his life. If you'd like to hear more from Jack, there are additional stories from his time in the war and after, and even some more marital advice in the extended podcast version of this episode, which you can find at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through these stories from our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. And I promised you if you found this podcast, there would be extra material here from Jack. There's plenty of it. And first, we'll have him in England during World War II.
Even before the invasion, I imagine if you're in England for that long, you were probably feeling the war and seeing the war and buzz bombs and, you know, bombed out buildings and things like that. Were there some things you saw that you still remember today?
Yes. In our hospital, when we had this huge hospital. Now, normally when a plane comes over, they do not, even the enemy won't drop it on hospitals. So we felt protected. But when the buzz bombs came out, they came out with two, the V1, V2. And when the buzz bombs would come, the first one you'd hear, that was a shocker. You'd hear it going, bup, 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 and then all of a sudden it stops. And where it stops, it goes down at an angle. And wherever it hits, whether it's a house or a hospital or a store or whatever it may be, it doesn't care. It just kills. And lots of them came over It was scary.
You heard him.
Heard him and saw him and saw the devastation from it. Some dropped near our hospital, and they were dropping all around there. And it was really strange because beside the bombing, there was some bombing, but then these buzz bombs would do it. I remember once getting the first taste of bombings and all. We were in a Quonset hut, and I went under a table. And all of a sudden, I'm there. And now, I want you to understand one thing. When I went into the war, I did not know God. I didn't really care about too much about God. It was not interesting. I was in gangs and so forth, and that's what my interest was. And here I was, we want to fight for my country, but God was not that important to me. But when the bombs hit, I saw this one guy get in the middle of the floor. I'm under the table because of the things would start falling. Mm-hmm. And his name was Sully. And he said, "Lord, if it's my time, I'm ready." And I looked and I said, "This guy is a nut." You know, so I got to talking to him later, and I said, what is it with you? And he told me about that he's ready, you know, if it's his time and so forth. And he asked me, and I said, "No, I don't go for it." He gave me he said, "Let me give you this thing." And because they had given him some. And he had this little New Testament. So he carried him, a small one.
Yep.
So I put it in my pocket. I figured if a bullet comes, maybe that'll stop it. Honest to God, that's the way
I've talked to guys that happened for.
Yeah, him, so. But he was the first Christian I made an inroad into my brain about God. Mm. Then, of course, I went through the invasions and a couple of invasions, and then later on I'll tell you more about how
sure.
I found him. On our 25th anniversary, because we ran off and got married the first time,
mm-hmm.
and it's all in the book, but on our 25th anniversary, we got married in the church. We were going to Magnolia Baptist Church. And interesting thing there is that my daughter sang at the wedding. My son was my best man. And my other daughter was the maid of honor. I created my own wedding party.
To renew the vows 25 years later.
25 years later, and yep. God was the head of our house. And that's we're going. My wife and I have a very interesting thing, and I just pass it on because I think other people... A lot of people have adopted it since they heard us doing it. After 12 o'clock, we've been doing this for about 3 years now. After 12 o'clock, we touch each other and say, "I love you, I love you, I love you." And then it's a win-win situation, but it's like what we call a got you deal. See, I got you. And so I touch you and I go, "I love you, I love you." Like we were sitting having dinner with some friends, and I looked at my watch. It was after 12, and I touched her and I said, "I love you, I love you, I love you." And she goes, "You creep." And the people said, "What did you call him a creep for?" And she said, "Because he got me." And she said, "But he said he loves you." She said, "Yeah, but he got me." You know,
because you did it before she did.
Before she did. And that's why she called. So anyway, a lot of people have adopted that. But I'll tell you one thing. If people would do that, they'd be surprised how that word love, "I love you," is so important. And it stays with you. By the way, there you know, on your touching lies, there was an interesting story. I just want to pass that on,
sure.
Kind of in closing, is that I was working at Walmart one time when things were, before I would get the pension or anything else, things were rough. I was about 87 years of age. And when I got to Walmart, I was working there, and I said, "Wow, I felt like I was on the bottom of the pole. Financially, things were getting rough. I had all these problems. I'm going through therapy or whatever it may be." But I said, I'm still going to try to touch lives if I can. And then so I did. And people would come through the check stand. And I'd say, "How you doing, young fellow?" And here I am, 89. And some guy said, "Yeah, life sucks, man. You know." And they give you all this problem. And I said, "How old are you?" And the guy say, 67. And I didn't want to tell him I was 80-something then, you know. But... So I would tell him, "I know what that's like, you know." Then I found God, and then he goes, "Does it work?" Then I would tell him a little bit about it. Well, anyway, it got around. But there was one woman that came through, because there was a lot of people. But one woman was pregnant, and she was telling me her problems. I said, "I'm going to be on a break if you can wait a few minutes." So we talked briefly. I prayed with her and everything. I was doing a show for this church, and there was a lawn deal with a bunch of chairs and people were all out there, and I'm ready to go on in about 15 minutes to do a show. And all of a sudden, I didn't have a name tag on, and I hear this woman yell, "Jack." And I walk over and I said, "Do I know you?" And she goes, "Yes." She was sitting there with a beautiful baby boy, blue-eyed baby boy, and her husband. And she said, "You worked at Walmart, didn't you, over a year ago or something like that?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I was that pregnant woman, and I was going through problems, and you talked to me, and you changed my life." And her husband said to me, "Is this the Jack you keep talking about?" And he said, "Yes." And he said, "Thank you for my wife." And then she said, "See this little blue-eyed baby boy?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I named him Jack after you."
Wow.
I cried. I was so touched. The only reason I tell the story is because what I want people to know is that you never know when you're going to touch a life, you know, and how important it is that you do these things, because it comes back. And I felt, God let me find this one woman of all the people I talked to that there, and I feel it's so important, touching lives.
Amen. Well said. Anything else you want to say about your wife?
Oh, I got a woman that we just, as I said, 70 years. I always tell people, this is my, when I do a show, I said, this is my wife of 70 years. There's nothing I wouldn't do for her. There's nothing she wouldn't do for me. We've gone 70 years doing nothing for each other. But I'll tell you the truth, she has been a blessing in my life. She put up with so much with me, and she is very patient. And we both love the Lord together, so it's been just great. And with our children, it just goes right on to them. We are a hugging, loving family, mm-hmm. And that's what's great.